Judge driven mad by LSD, despite never taking it. I went to trial on September 21st, 1992, almost 14 months after arrest. Only Rick and Martha could attend, as I had no warning as to the date. They testified on my behalf, while the judge made a great show of yawning. The prosecutors charged me with 500 hits, which carried a 14-year minimum mandatory sentence and $50,000 fine. Although I had cooperated, which allowed the judge to reduce the sentence, he did not, and I got the full load, along with the $860,000 stamp tax. Don Gale and Lieutenant Wood gave me street clothes to wear, including pants much too big for me, and no belt. That way, I had to use one hand to hold up my pants, which they found very amusing. Oddly enough, I saw some old Nazi newsreels of show trials where the Germans did the same thing to their defendants to make them look ridiculous. We've come a long way. The entire 14 months before trial, I was led to believe that I would be released quite soon, even with 14 years, due to time served and parole after 1/8 of the sentence. Thus, I was not too upset with the verdict. After a week in the Salisbury jail, I went to the Piedmont Correctional Institution in Salisbury, a high-rise, close-custody prison where inmates were processed before shipping to their camps. There, I took an intelligence test, and the psychologist harumphed and said I was not the smartest inmate that had ever been incarcerated in North Carolina. Better luck next time. Finally, they had to level with me about my punishment. My lawyer, Don Gale, and everyone else in the system lied to me constantly all the way to this point to keep me pliable. In fact, the 1/8 parole was not possible with trafficking charges of any kind. I was only eligible for parole in the last 90 days of my sentence. My pretrial time counted day for day. From now on, with good time, I could get a day off for every day served, and by working could get a week off per month. That would bring the total down to about 5 years. Figuring out work was going to be a problem, as I was disabled and physical labor was not possible. Meanwhile, the hours each day of spiritual practice did have results. I was having extraordinary experiences, despite not necessarily having my act together in the physical plane. It was very beneficial to have a single cell at Central, so that I could feel secure in letting go of my body. Here at the high rise, I had a roommate, who was a decent fellow and not in the cell most of the time. I was meditating prone on the lower bunk one day and floated out of my body and was loitering just below the upper bunk like a long, fuzzy light bulb when he came back to the cell to fetch something. I had never been in a situation where I was in a high state and someone else was around, and I wondered if he could see anything odd. The only thing I could think of doing was to turn and face the wall, still a couple of feet above my physical body. He didn't see anything and turned and left. That was reassuring. Now my concern would be being mistaken for dead. Some years later, a friend caught me not at home, so to speak, and I wasn't breathing. Quite a mystery. Despite these excursions, my nerves were still shot. I tried reading the Psalms and the prayers Diane sent, but couldn't get through them. My simple Hindu mantras were more effective in this tense situation. Rick introduced me to a local woman who showed some interest in my case and thought I'd been badly treated. She came to visit, and we talked through the glass. I really appreciated the kindness and wrote her a letter of thanks. After not hearing back, I asked Rick what happened. Turns out, she was dependent on some government programs to help out raising her kid. The sheriff told her I was a hardened criminal, with many criminal friends, and if she continued being in contact with me, he'd see to it that her assistance was terminated. Arbeit macht frei. After a couple of weeks, they sent me to Stanley Correctional Institution, a small camp in Albemarle, not very far from Cleveland. This was a medium custody unit with about 100 inmates. I couldn't go to minimum until the pending mushroom charge was dropped. I needed a camp with a library, since this was the only work I could do, and where there was a disciplinary section with single cells so I could have a place to sleep and meditate. Somehow, I managed to be classified as sufficiently disabled to need a single cell, but fit enough to work. Central Prison was 65% to 70% black, but from now on the population would be about 80% to 90% black. There was a small schoolroom where I sat in on classes and helped the teachers give basic skills to inmates while I waited until the library job was available. One day, the teachers were helping some inmates with addition, and I gave a little extemporaneous talk on Cantor's diagonal argument for the existence of uncountable sets as proof of transfinite numbers. They didn't quite get it. Oddly enough, just as I moved from Raleigh back to my home territory, the Corlettes moved from Cleveland to Raleigh, where Diane had a new Episcopal church. As a result, I didn't see her again until I left prison. There was an upright piano in a little practice room that inmates could use. It was terribly out of tune, and I offered to pay to have it brought to pitch. For some reason, this was not possible. For one of those, "if we let you have the piano tuned, we'd have to let everyone have the piano tuned," sorts of reasons. But in fact, I couldn't bear the idea of trying to make music anymore, after the destruction of all that I had worked for and the total rejection of what I had sent off to musicians. After a little while, I simply accepted leaving music entirely behind as a bad dream, with a few happy moments. Anton wrote from the Philippines that he was about to leave for Japan to show the emperor pictures of an ivory Buddha that had been looted by the Japanese in World War II. The legend was that Japan would be destroyed by the year 2000 if it was not returned to Japan. Anton was expecting his group to be paid $10 million for their labors. Never heard of this again. There was a book in the library about Vivekananda, who was one of the founders of the Ramakrishna Vivekananda movement at the end of the 19th century. I got in touch with them and got more literature. Susan sent a book by Thich Nhat Hanh that was most helpful, and of course there was the literature from Bo and Sita Lozoff. I got up most mornings at 2 or 3 a.m., draped long underwear over my head to block the lights, and did pranayama and mantras before lying down again. The officers were puzzled at all of this, but got used to it after a while. They joked that they'd bust me for disembodied escape. My extremely slow pace of walking resulted from both arthritis and not having anywhere to go in a tiny camp, which earned me the nickname Lightning. Now that I had a place to study and read, I started corresponding with Phil Boulder, a prominent boat designer, libertarian, and terrific guy. He was sympathetic to my situation, and over the next several months talked me through a series of 13 drafts of my peculiar design called the Anchorite. This was a 20-foot boat designed to be able to cross large oceans with several different rigs possible, from a single gaff sail to full-rigged brigantine. The idea was to sail to India and go up the Ganges, but I didn't seriously think I could pull it off in reality, given my physical limitations. The boat could be constructed of plywood, aluminum, or steel. I had a calculator, but no drafting equipment, so I designed the boat numerically. Bob Hicks published an article on the design in Messing About in Boats in 1995. The authorities kept insisting I had a drug problem, even sending letters to friends saying I had been convicted of trafficking cocaine. In early December, they shipped me out to Craigie Prison in Asheville to freeze for a month, taking the first three steps of a 12-step program. The instructors didn't want me there, since I wasn't addicted to anything, unlike all the others. This gave me a chance to hear once again a long list of horror stories from alcohol and narcotics, but I didn't have any of my own except for what the state had done to me. My drug stories were about profound experiences that were inspirational and which changed my life toward a spiritual path. Theirs were about disasters, dependency, and a peculiar nostalgia for puking their guts out, which didn't sound like a lot of fun. One of the instructors was a woman who recovered from alcoholism and told how, after a bender, she would wake up with a stranger in her bed. I complained bitterly that this had never happened to me. Okay, it was for a laugh, but it was disturbingly true. 1993, Adventures in Sanskrit. By now, I'd done what I could with boat design. Over the years, I'd tried my hand at reciting the Bhagavad Gita in Sanskrit without knowing much about the language. Now that I had some time on my hands, I bought an Indian high school Sanskrit textbook dating from the Victorian era. This was extremely confusing, so I ordered a modern textbook written by two professors at Berkeley, which was very good. Also, I bought the huge Sanskrit English Dictionary by Sir Monier Monier Williams, M.A.K.C.I.E., on D.C.L., Oxon, on L.L.D. Calcutta, on Ph.D. Göttingen. The hyphenated author of the hyphenated book was an Oxford don who took 50 years to complete his masterpiece, finishing just before his death in 1899. His chair had been endowed for the specific purpose of translating the Bible into Sanskrit, quote, to enable his countrymen to proceed in the conversion of the natives of India to the Christian religion, close quote. It didn't work. Although laughable in hindsight, Westerners actually considered South Asia to be godless, much like Billy and Franklin Graham do now. Perhaps the Victorians weren't paying attention after the long boat ride. Indians who knew Sanskrit had 10,000 books to read that came from their culture instead of just the one Bible, which did not. I spent much of the next 2 years doing my best to learn what I could of this remarkable language. The barber at Albemarle had been a quaalude dealer. One night at his supplier's home, he took exception to the way a transaction had gone and beheaded the supplier with a knife. He got life as a result and had been in prison for a couple of decades. I just barely knew him, but one day he took me aside and said we needed to talk away from the others. He said that someone told him I'd been spreading bad stories about him and was causing trouble. I said this was clearly false. We were only slightly acquainted and had no arguments whatsoever. Someone was just stirring things up. He said, fine, and that was that. Nothing to lose your head about. I had no qualms about future haircuts, but he didn't give me shaves. I got in touch with the International Society of Krishna Consciousness prison ministry people, and they assigned me a devotee named Jamuna, then living at the Hillsboro Temple. We had both been at several rainbow gatherings, but hadn't met. She was quite obsessive. One of her friends called her a key-holing religious projectile. We traded letters for a few weeks, but I tired of her orthodoxy and fanaticism. Preaching is not listening. The Maha Mantra, which I'd used for many years, was very valuable, and I got some benefit out of the contact. After I got out of prison, I looked her up. She'd quit the temple and ISKCON. We went out for dinner, where she slugged down a beer. Afterwards, she told me to go away, which, by my standards, is a normal date. On May 9th, Mom, John, and Jackie came to visit. Halfway through, Mom said she had a sore throat and went back to the car. John told me that was a story, and that I was lucky she lasted that long. This was my only visit with family during my years in prison. Meanwhile, back in Nashville, Burns was in a nursing home going senile, and my cousin, the daughter of Mom's brother David, was training to join the police. In time, she became a narc. Medium security required a strip search before and after my visits. This was also true when I went to a doctor's office away from the camp. One day, I was strip searched 4 times. Rules is rules. Visits to doctors were the only chance I had to be away from the camp. As I was in handcuffs and leg irons, and in the gray uniform, accompanied by guards, any civilians I encountered recoiled in fear and disgust. I tried to project love and kindness as best I could, and kept my mantras going. I had written Ram Dass some time before, and in mid-May I got a response from him, which was most welcome. We traded letters from time to time, which helped bolster my faith and keep my perspective. His assistant Marlene gave me the address for the Lama Foundation, a wonderful spiritual community 20 miles north of Taos, New Mexico. This is where Ram Dass wrote Be Here Now. I wrote them often and hoped to visit after release and maybe stay there. A new black inmate showed up one day and caused a bit of a stir. His name was Willie Monteith Jr., better known as Willie M. At age 9, he was removed from his mother's abusive care and spent most of his childhood in detention or asylums. Lawyers who saw a chance to fix a major social problem and make a buck at the same time used his case as a class-action lawsuit for impoverished, mentally disabled, and violent youth. The result was the Willie M. program, which cost $774 million during its run from 1980 to 1998, helping some 6,000 youngsters. Willie became a child celebrity, even having dinner with Governor Hunt. As an adult, he was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder and was addicted to cocaine and alcohol. At 23, he sold crack to a narc and ended up in my world. Willie was clearly retarded, but the teachers at our camp said that people had obviously worked with him on basic skills. He could go so far and no further. In later years, he was in and out of jail. As of this writing, he is living on the streets in Charlotte, broke. Social Security did with him as they did with me, cutting him off when he was arrested, then automatically turning him down when he reapplied, hoping he wouldn't be sharp enough to get a lawyer. It's a rough world. And a corrupt one, too. One inmate I knew at Stanley had hired a hitman who was arrested and charged with 9 murders. The prosecutors named their fee, and $150,000 later, he was released. A little later, I heard of an offer to buy paroles. The cost was $10,000 to the lawyer and $10,000 to the parole board. This was shut down shortly after I heard of it. Such stories are highly unlikely to make the papers, since, after all, there are hitmen and rich people on the streets who like things just the way they are. I had a regular correspondence with Dad since arrest, but in June he wrote a long, angry, bitter letter that I found insulting and intolerable. After my reply, we did not communicate for a year. We had a preacher visit weekly, and he would play Jimmy Swaggart videos and other born-again propaganda. A friend sent a couple of recordings from Crippaloo Center in Massachusetts, and I could use the preacher's cassette player to hear Amrit Desai chanting in an incredibly tone-deaf and raucous manner. One hearing was enough. Desai was making something like $400,000 a year running his ashram. Residents of Crippaloo had to take vows of celibacy and obedience to Desai. The next year, he resigned after admitting having sex with 3 followers. It's hard to find a spiritual group where something like this has not happened eventually. The alpha male desexualizes the beta males so he can have the women for himself. Been working that way for at least 1,000,000 years. I had plenty of problems dealing with sensual desires myself. Early one morning, I had a vivid vision of Ramakrishna burning out parts of my brain to free me from lust. It worked for a few hours. Moving up in the world. The library job opened up in July, which meant 11 days of good time per month instead of 6, and an income of $4.90 a week. I spent weeks straightening out the mess, organizing the material by subject, and pleading with the system for books and magazines. Inmates usually used the library as a place to get away from the guards and a handy place to stash contraband, so my efforts were not appreciated. I met only 2 other inmates arrested for LSD my whole time in prison. One was in the Salisbury high-rise while I was being processed. He'd already done 7 years and had more to go. The other was here in Stanley. He was busted as a first offense at age 19 with 4,000 hits, did not cooperate, and got 70 years. He was only in medium custody through some sort of paperwork error that he did not complain about. Anton wrote that when he was in Sulawesi, he was taken to the mountain hideaway of a 226-year-old prophet, where, inside a large 7-step pyramid, he was shown a sacred book in Aramaic. The prophet was the incarnation of Adam and Jesus and Angel Gabriel and all the saints and founders of all the religions, and goes to Mecca every Friday. He controlled a secret holy treasure of gold from heaven, which was Solomon's treasure, the secret treasure of the Knights of Malta, and the Tsar's treasure, among others. This would replace our present economic system after the tribulation and restoration of the old royal bloodlines. Conveniently, he brought back many of the Buddhist texts that had been lost on Earth from the Western Paradise planets, and so forth and so on. I'm sure the dear reader gets letters like this all the time. But of course Anton was a little strapped for cash at the moment. I think he said the prophet was the living Buddha Lu Shengyang, who lives in Redmond, Washington, not far from Master Gates of Microsoft. I may be wrong, as letters were garbled. For months I had been pleading for the return of my diaries and photographs from the federal court, where they were held as evidence in Carla's trial. She was sentenced to 7 years in June, and finally I got word that my diaries would be returned, minus a few pages. That was a big relief, and made a large part of this book possible. I was allowed 1 10-minute collect call every 2 weeks. In mid-August, I phoned Susan and Ray in Cleveland. They told me that Susan was diagnosed a few days before with a relapse of her leukemia, and was about to get chemotherapy and transfusions in Charlotte. She was quite frightened, as they told her without treatment she would live only 3 or 4 weeks. After she got to the hospital and started the therapy, she was not able to read or write letters and was in a great deal of pain. They tried an experimental treatment in Baltimore where they removed bone marrow, treated it, killed what remained in her body, and then replaced the marrow. This was her only chance. In early September, Mom wrote to tell me that she had been diagnosed with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, with an average life expectancy of 12 years. Overhearing conversations was an odd pastime. Some would discuss the comparative virtues of brass knuckles. Another bunch debated the proper ammunition to use in drive-by shootings. A black pimp described how he would take all the money from one of his prostitutes, then rape her to show her who was boss. She would always come back the next day to work for him again. I couldn't quite figure that out. Inmates were limited to possessions that could fit in a single plastic garbage bag. This had always been a difficulty for me, as I started ordering books while in Central Prison, and kept copies of my many letters and papers. When I had too many to store, I sent them home with visitors for storage. The superintendent at Stanley was very suspicious of my ordering so many books, even though I was the librarian, and delayed my money orders. The system is not set up for intellectual development. You're expected to spend the time learning about brass knuckles and ammunition. In my absence, links to the outer world were fraying. Jim and Gary came to visit in October, and Jim brought with him a letter I'd written 2 weeks ago. It was unopened and had been lying on the floor of his car the whole time. It was not unusual for me to wait 6 months for a response to a letter, and many never responded at all. It was like watching your own slow funeral. This is supposed to be a good spiritual exercise, but it didn't seem like a lot of fun at the time. Jim had a lot of things to do, and handling my money and storing my belongings was becoming too much of a burden. I had no way of doing anything for people in return, so everything I needed was on someone's shoulders, costing them time and effort. Most inmates lost all contact with friends after a couple of years and were completely isolated, so my situation was much better than theirs. I shuffle off to my last camp. Just before Thanksgiving, I transferred to Mecklenburg Correctional Center in Huntersville, about 20 miles north of Charlotte. This was a close minimum custody road camp of about 120 inmates. I needed close minimum so that it would have single cells, and this camp had a library to work in. I started off in the little school waiting for the job to become available. At last, I had access to pay phones for 10-minute collect calls most days. I could pull in National Public Radio from Charlotte and two classical radio stations. One of these broadcast from Davidson College, about 4 miles away. I could probably pick it up from the bed springs. An inmate wondered what I was listening to one day, and I pulled up my earplugs and handed them over. I was listening to one of Bach's Brandenburg Concertos, some of the most exquisite music on the planet. He put the earplugs in, and half a second later yanked them out as if they had inflicted a severe electric shock across his brain. Anton spent the summer in Singapore, then got a call saying His Royal Highness Prince Kdomo I of Lesotho wanted to meet him in New York to help sell 500 tons of gold. All Anton's expenses were paid to stay at a 5-star hotel, while he and one of his Knights of Malta associates met with the CIA demanding $820 million from Yamashita's gold be returned. Prince Kdomo withdrew from the deal after a month, but Anton's godfather kept the party going for months. Anton danced in the discos to 4 a.m. every night. In 1998, Kdomo, Crown Prince of Botswana of the court of Flefu, whose real name was Mali St. Amali, conspired with others to defraud financial institutions in the city of London and was sentenced to 4 years in prison. Three retired people from Davidson, Anne, June, and Walter, came to the camp every Friday to visit and distribute books and magazines, some of which I collected for the library. This was an enormous help and a great humanizing factor for us all. 1994. Lama Foundation sent a copy of Miracle of Love, a superb compilation of stories about Neem Karoli Baba. I had been paying a lot of attention to him before, but this book helped put him in focus in a most remarkable way. Every couple of weeks, a fair number of inmates were more or less randomly picked for urine tests. I wasn't using any drugs, of course, and even if I had, I wouldn't be using what they'd test for. Dirty urine was mostly from pot, and resulted in a couple of weeks locked in a single cell, plus loss of good time. Hardly worth it, one would think, and pretty much everyone who smoked ended up doing a turn in a cell. But that didn't seem to be much of a deterrence. It reminded me of my old NTSU buddy, who was popped for smoking joints on a nuclear submarine. Inmates just didn't care all that much if they got caught. What would the cops do? Arrest them? And they really wanted to get stoned. I saw their point. I didn't trip because acid was too weak and temporary. I was using other methods for transforming my consciousness, which would not be of interest to any but a very few of my fellows. I paid no attention to dope smoke, knowing that it just meant more mellow inmates. Crack was a different story. The stuff smells incredibly toxic, an odor you would expect of a fire at a chemical plant specializing in plastics or nerve gas. Crackheads were highly unpopular if they continued to use in prison. Some inmates had parents who were rock stars and were fully aware of the consequences. At Central Prison, I saw people coming in still buzzed who had committed murders while stoned on crack. They were grinning and completely without any feelings of having done anything wrong or any concerns about consequences to follow. At least with alcohol, there usually was remorse when people woke up in prison charged for murders they didn't remember committing. One white crackhead smoked out of a broken pen one evening, and when the other inmates, black and white, figured out what was going on, they jumped him, stole his jewelry, and gave him a good scare. I was glad to see him go off to the single cells for a while. Early in the year, Susan responded well to the bone marrow transplant, and it appeared that she could make a recovery. However, her health turned for the worse, and in February, she came home from the hospital to die. She passed on March 3rd at age 47. It was a bleak and lonely time for the little town of Cleveland, and for everyone who knew and loved her. Thankfully, she came to visit during meditations. Ram Dass sent a consoling note with one of his favorite quotes from the Tibetan Zhangzen tradition. "Prolong not the past, invite not the future, disturb not your innate wakefulness, fear not appearances. There is nothing more than that." Of course, this book is all about prolonging the past, speculating about the future, listing disturbing events, and things I've been afraid of. There is nothing more than that here. In May, I finally got the library job. This allowed me some semi-private space and storage, which was very valuable. With severe overcrowding, I started being bumped out of my single cell and onto a bunk in a cage with 50 other men. Whenever that happened, things were very stressful and meditation far more difficult. By the end of 1994, I was permanently crowded out of the single cells and just had to adapt. June and Anne showed me some beads that they had grown called Job's Tears, which is a kind of grass seed that dries to a lovely blue-gray color with intricate patterns. I had been in need of chanting beads, called a mala, for years and saw this as a chance to make my own. They planted some for me, and when they were ready, brought a cupful to the camp. I split them with another inmate and started the conspiracy to put them together. There was a school for teaching heating and air conditioning at the camp, and a friend snuck a piece of wood into the shop and made a small disc for the beginning part of the mala. Then I asked an inmate who was working in the sewing room for some sturdy thread and a contraband needle, which I concealed by taping to the ink supply tube inside a ballpoint pen. Finally, I strung 108 beads together and had my official Hindu mala at long last. In 1989, inmates won a lawsuit requiring 50 square feet of living space per inmate in prisons that had to be met by the summer of 1944. Now that it was spring of 1994, the living space per inmate was only 35 square feet. To meet the court order would require releasing 4,000 inmates. Nothing happened. Next time you don't have much to do, trace out an area 6 feet by 6 feet. That's what we had. One fellow in his early 20s was clearly not quite right. He enjoyed pulling the wings off bumblebees, but I knew enough to mind my own business, even though I had befriended many an insect during my incarceration. One day he asked me, "Could you teach me German? And by the way, where is Germany?" Turns out he had been born on an army base in Germany and came to the U.S. as an infant. His parents never bothered with the citizenship details, and when time came for him to make up his mind, he knew nothing about it. So, legally, he was now a German citizen. He was brought to court on 5 traffic violations, each of which was a misdemeanor. Usually this would result in a fine and a scolding, but as I say, he wasn't quite right. And he told the judge, "Fuck you." She did not take kindly to this, and sentenced him to the maximum 2 years for each charge to serve consecutively. As a result, he was looking at 10 years for 2 words. In addition, she ordered him deported. So, he now had to learn a lot more geography and languages than he got in school, where evidently he learned nothing of either. No lawyer stood to make a buck by helping him out, so he was out of luck. The only German I know is either faked or out of music scores, so I wasn't much good either. One day I noticed small white flecks of dirt on my clothes and mentioned it to a black inmate out of earshot of the others that, quote, "It is remarkable how much white trash there is around here," close quote. Words spread quickly, and soon another black inmate came up to me and with a big grin mentioned my remark, which I acknowledged while keeping it in the context of laundry. Should have said it long ago, as it won me major points. I had few hassles for some time after that. Which was a good thing, because in June, the O.J. Simpson murder psychodrama started. All of the blacks were rooting for him, and all of the whites were disgusted. This kept going until October of 1995, when O.J. was acquitted. There was instant pandemonium when the news hit the prison, with the black inmates exultant that their hero got away with cutting the throat of, quote, "that white bitch," unquote. This was a kind of revenge opera that was horrifying to watch. Not so much the sordid details of Simpson's actions, but the reactions right here of the people surrounding me. At this point, all I wanted was to get out of prison without injury and get the hell away from lower-class black culture. In September, I got news concerning a Rainbow family friend. Jadine Blount lived for some time at Rainbow Valley, north of Denton, then moved to a poor black neighborhood in Dallas. She was one of the few whites heavily involved with Rastafarians, and to reflect that, changed her name to Jadine. She had a daughter with a black man who left immediately and had no role in his daughter's life. Jadine was beaten and fatally stabbed in the throat in front of her 4-year-old daughter during the theft of her freshly cashed and very modest paycheck. Part of my duties as librarian was a daily trek into the single cells, going down the corridor with a cart full of books they had either asked for or might like. Most books were westerns or romances, while the books in greatest demand were about crime, especially black gangs or the mafia. I tried to include more uplifting and informative material in case I could spark interest. Sometimes the clientele were pretty rough and would tear up the books and throw them into the hallway or clog up the toilets with them. Only once in a while would things get too threatening, and then I would ask an officer for backup to make my rounds. I wanted to be on good terms, since people would come out of the cells and into the general population from time to time. I tried to use this job as a way to do something kind and useful for people in a desperate situation, but my altruism was hardly constant. Neem Karoli Baba became more and more important to me. One morning in meditation he came by, and I wondered what it would be like to see the world like he did. He took off his face and put it over mine, and I got a look for about a second before blacking out. Pretty amazing character. Another time he said he was in charge of what happened on these jaunts to other planes. I joined an international pen pal group based in India, mostly to find women to write to, but others as well. One correspondent was Swami Mangala Bilashi, who styled himself as Babaji, Universal Monk, Head, Mission International, Temporal Seat of Humanism. He said he was the living Neem Karoli Baba for me, would be my savior by showing me the righteous path, would wash off my sins of this life and other lives too, would find me a wife, and so on. He had the big, long, white beard and everything, and gave me a special mantra. I'm not sure he understood that this Westerner was broke. I sent him friendly letters from time to time. Then I wrote him a letter in Sanskrit, with no future tenses. It wasn't for any spiritual reasons, I just hadn't learned them yet, since the grammar is really intense. Never heard back from him after that. 1995. In the cold months we were cooped up inside, and with little ventilation I gagged on the cigarette smoke. The extra confinement made inmates edgy. I needed to ask a large inmate about something, and as he was facing away from me, I tapped him on the shoulder to get his attention. Mistake! He whipped around, got in my face as I backed rapidly away, and shouted, "Don't ever touch me!" "Okay, okay, no problem," I said, and smoothed things over. He was totally freaked out. But that was mild compared to the other time I tapped an inmate on the shoulder. The officers knew I had an insomnia problem, but now that I was out in the main cell block, sleeping in a room with 50 guys, they decided to mess with me. There was an insane black inmate that had usually been in the single cells. Sometimes he would roll naked down the corridor. He was way, way out of it. They brought him out to sleep with us and put him on the bunk over mine. He spent the whole night shifting around, switching head to foot, moaning, bouncing, and in general making any attempt at sleep impossible. After several hours of this, in the early morning as he thrashed, I ventured to tap him on the shoulder so I could speak with him. Little did I know that he was asleep. He awoke and started hooting and hollering, waking the entire room as I ran to the far side. Everybody thought it was hilarious, although I was quite afraid. The officer in charge came in and took him back to the single cell. They'd had their fun. I had a subscription to Scientific American, and in the February issue there was an article by Seth Putterman from UCLA about sonoluminescence. When degassed water is exposed to ultrasound, under the right conditions there can be cavitation bubbles that emit light. With some tweaking, a single bubble will stay in the center of a chamber and flash light in bursts only picoseconds long at the frequency of the sound, typically 20,000 times a second. Theory broke down, and no one knew how the light was produced or how hot the bubble got. The physics was very intriguing, especially since if the bubbles collapsed small enough and got hot enough with deuterium and tritium gas, fusion might be possible. As a result, I dropped Sanskrit and started freshening up my physics. There was a huge multi-volume encyclopedia of physics and chemistry dating from 1962 in the library, untouched for decades, and I mined its contents for anything of value. Over the next 14 months, I designed a series of fusion reactors, including material I used 15 years later in my doctoral dissertation. Ultimately, I crunched some numbers that made it abundantly clear that no power-producing reactor could ever work with this method, even in the best possible case. But by then, I'd studied a great deal of physics and gotten my old interest back. Unlike almost everything I did, this actually had vocational potential. It was very difficult for me to wait months at a time for people to write me back. Even after years in prison, I never managed to adapt to the reality that my friends and acquaintances had full lives and sometimes hardly wrote letters to anyone. Sitting in a cage for prolonged periods waiting for a reply was so painful that I would end up writing to people I loved and needed to have on my side with considerable bitterness and annoyance. This made people even more reluctant to communicate with me. Every Christmas, local church groups would bring in poinsettias, and I would keep one alive for most of the next year in the library window. This spring, there was a large hatch of the local species of small brown praying mantises, not to be confused with the large green Chinese jobs. I grew four of them on my plant from very small hatchlings. It was a challenge to find minute bugs for them to eat when they were very young. Once they were mature, they could take down formidable prey. I tied thread onto yellow jackets and other wasps, allowing them to fly on a leash, and the mantises could knock them down and gobble them up. Their eyesight and intelligence must have been superb. In one experiment, I used thread to dangle insects past them, and generally they would ignore such treats. But if I dangled a spider by a thread, they would attack at once. They could tell which arthropod should be at the end of a line. The inmates were enthralled by the graphic violence of my little monsters and would line up with potential meals they had found on the yard. This got the attention of the camp warden when he saw inmates actually enjoying something, which is not part of the punishment ethos. He ordered me to get rid of the mantises, although I argued that this was a chance to teach a little biology on the fly, so to speak. Ram Dass very generously sent a package with a large collection of cassette tapes. Previously, such packages were returned to the senders, but this time they let me keep them in the chaplain's office. Cassette players were contraband, since inmates made tattoo machines with them, but I managed to hide one. I kept copies of several of his books in the library and encouraged inmates to read them, as well as the volumes from Bo and Sita Lozoff, who kept me well stocked with their literature. In 1994, Dad collapsed a couple of times in his apartment and started treatments for diabetes. He had chronic problems with congestive heart failure and was looking for a rest home that would have more services than the retirement apartment complex he'd been in for many years. On September 28th, he felt intestinal discomfort and went to the hospital. They took an x-ray and found bowel perforations. They said they could make him comfortable, but that was all they could do. He died an hour later. Brother John took care of the details. Dad was 80 years old. He hadn't gotten around to modifying his will for the last 30 years, so everything went to Mom. A month later, I wrote to Akanda mentioning some matters that I wanted to discuss and clear up so that we could have a better relationship and understand one another. She thought this was an attack of some sort and wrote back a curt note cutting off communication. We were out of touch for many years. First half of 1996. From time to time, I went to the Evangelical Baptist Sunday service given by a visiting preacher. It was primitive stuff, but at least it was appropriate for many of the inmates. They were looking for a gang to join that would get them away from the gangs they were with, and Christianity offered just that kind of ride. It was not possible to know when I'd get out exactly, but I knew that it would be sometime probably between June and October. I looked around for somewhere to live and some way to get by while waiting for SSI checks to start again. My hip was in bad shape. but I couldn't get an operation until I had benefits and a secure place to live set up. Getting a regular job was not realistic. Mom couldn't take me in for more than a week. Akonda wasn't speaking to me and was impoverished herself, and John and Jackie up in Massachusetts turned me away, even though they had room. I wanted to go back to school to study physics and nuclear engineering, possibly at NCSU, conveniently sited just a couple of blocks from Central Prison, but setting that up would take a lot of time. Other prisoners also were ready to get out. One of my friends had been down for 20 years and finally qualified for minimum custody camp, where he could work on the road crew. He had 6 months left before release when he figured he'd had enough and ran off. They were searching for him in a swamp and noticed the tip of his shoe sticking above the water. Back to the pokey for him for a few more years. I'd been corresponding with Llama Foundation in New Mexico for years and was dismayed in early May when I heard news accounts of the Hondo Fire. This covered 7,500 acres and wiped out 20 of the 23 Llama buildings, burning all the large pine trees on their side of the mountain. It would take Llama years of hard labor to rebuild, and since I couldn't swing a hammer, I would have to look elsewhere. With considerable trepidation, I wrote to the Maharishi University of Management in Iowa to see if that was a realistic option. I never was a fan of transcendental meditation, since it seemed to be oriented to maximizing profit. A close look at their claims did little to dispel my misgivings. They sent a video including footage of their well-publicized yogic flying, which was really hopping in a lotus position. To make it look like flying, they used slow motion and frozen frames. It became clear that they wouldn't teach me the skills I wanted, nor could I pay them the high fees required, nor would I be free to practice my own spiritual path. They considered TM to be the only way, and everything else was prohibited. I would have had a more flexible and liberal education at West Point, so I told them no thanks. Bo and Sita Lozoff were just starting to set up a residential center for ex-convicts and people who worked with prisoners called Kindness House in Mebane, a rural setting about 45 miles west of Raleigh. They were not ready for new members yet, but I would keep in touch and visit after release. This sounded best of all, since they were oriented around Neem Karoli Baba, and my prison experience could be valuable in helping others. I arranged with my paddling buddy Greg Shanding to sleep in a storage room at his home in Charlotte for a couple of months while finding more permanent digs. Finally, without warning, I was released on July 19th. As I signed the final papers, I let the officers know that they had wasted their time and money, and that they were in no position to give me lessons in morality.